it's so deep in our subconscious, this like, I'll just look pretty over here on the sidelines. I'll be picked. Mm. It's a certain type of passivity that I think we're taught as women that that's what's seemly. That's what's appropriate. You're not supposed to go out there and get what you want or ask for what you want.
I know you are doing the best that you can right now. Your relationships matter to you. You are important. And yet, over time, we get stuck. We get lost, or we stop showing up as our true self. We get hung up on the stories we tell ourselves, the comparisons, or feeling like we are not good enough. I'm Not Your Shrink is a podcast aimed at helping you feel connected to yourself, to others, and to live a life that is in line with what matters most to you. I'm Dr. Tracy Dalgleish, clinical psychologist and couples therapist. I bring you clinical knowledge and evidence-based research, experiences of sitting in the therapist chair, and being a wife and mother to talk about everyday issues we all face to help you change the dialogue in your life. Let's dive in. What if we could live in a world where we stop telling ourselves that we should be a good girl, the good mom, the good partner, the good daughter-in-law? What if we could live in a world where we stopped glorifying our busyness and instead honored our need to rest? What if we could live in a world where we stopped projecting our uncomfortable feelings onto other women and instead turned inwards and asked ourselves, what is this really about for me? When I first picked up the book On Our Best Behavior, I immediately knew that I was going to be shaking up some deep internalized beliefs and messages that I and so many women have held onto and lived by that aren't really helping us live a meaningful life, which is why I'm so excited to sit with today's guest. Elise Lonin is a writer, editor, and podcast host who lives in Los Angeles with her husband, Rob, and their two sons, Max and Sam. She is the host of Pulling the Thread, a podcast focused on pulling apart the stories we tell about who we are and then putting those threads back together. While she's co-written 12 books, including 5 New York Times bestsellers, her first book under her own name, On Our Best Behavior, The 7 Deadly Sins and the Price Women Pay to Be Good, was also an instant New York Times bestseller. Previously, she was the chief content officer of Goop, where she co-hosted the Goop podcast, the Goop Lab on Netflix, and led the brand's content strategy and programming, including the launch of a magazine with Condé Nast and a book imprint. Elise is a frequent contributor to Oprah and has written for the New York Times, Elle Decor, Stylist, and more. Let's go into today's conversation. One of the things that I appreciate, Elise, about your work is that you are frequently asking questions. You have a willingness to be a seeker, to question information, and it's what led me not only to your podcast called Pulling the Thread, which has so many meaningful conversations on it. I enjoy listening, but also your best-selling book, On Our Best Behavior. And your book has unpacked these ancient rules that have been used to condition and control women's lives every day. And reading your book, there were so many moments where I always say it's a good book when I want to throw it across the room because it's hitting something inside of me that I need to hear and that I don't like and I have to face. So thank you for this work that you're doing and for all that you're sharing.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. Glad to know that it's both resonant and infuriating. I aim to please.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting when I'd read the book. So you had also completed the Enneagram. I'm a number one. So I feel like we are in good company together, both being those perfectionist number ones that appreciate control.
My Enneagram number is now disputed. I don't know my Enneagram number anymore. A whole nother conversation. I might be a 5. I might be a 6, but I've labored under the idea of being a 1. That's for sure.
Fair enough. Maybe we could talk about the driving force behind the book, On Our Best Behavior. What was going on for you at the time? What was leading you to write about the 7 deadly sins that we as women experience?
Throughout my career, I've been a ghostwriter, mostly in the world of books, almost actually completely. I don't know why I said mostly. I'd never written my own book. I was convinced I didn't have a book in me, and I very much preferred to stand behind other people and help them shape their ideas and stories and use their platforms to sort of shove ideas into the culture. It was much, much more comfortable. And, you know, it's sort of a confluence of events, namely working on a book and having it be just like a maddening experience outside of my own control. But ultimately, at the end of the process, realizing that I had sort of wasted a year of work, et cetera. And my agent saying, you know, like, what's wrong with you? Like, let's get to the bottom of whatever it is in you that's so convinced that you don't have a book in you. And it was sort of that push. It was my brother-in-law / best friend dying in his sleep when he was 39. Just a confluence of events, I think, that started to not shake me awake, but start to rethink how I had imagined or in how much I had internalized this idea that it is of much higher value to be in service to the world and hidden versus sort of out there in the world, and how much judgment I had about myself or any interest in being seen as doing my own work. And so that was a big part of it, was an opening to the universe and a saying, okay, like, I recognize that this is an odd, I don't know what I'm proving or what I'm doing here. But I'm open. And then also because of my long history of writing books, I recognize, one, like, what a labor they are, and two, how many people settle on an idea that seems actually in retrospect to be quite small. And then they're left, you know, talking about that idea or standing behind that idea for years, right? It takes a long time to write a book. And so I didn't want to write a small book, not in the context of how it might be received, because you really have absolutely no control over that. But I wanted to write a book that felt like I could easily, happily spend 3 years up front researching, thinking about writing this book, and then ideally, hopefully, you hope, years after talking about it. And so I waited. I didn't end up ultimately waiting that long because, again, I think that once I sort of opened to the idea, then it moved quite fast. But it was this opening, and then it was sort of the fulmination of a big enough question, which for me became, what is it in me? And what is it in our culture? Why are women conditioned to be so hard on ourselves and then on each other, while simultaneously being fed this idea that that's sort of naturally who we are? Like, what is that? I wanted to understand that instinct in myself. You know, you get into the sort of, well, I'm hard on other women because I just expect more from them, right? We see this all over our culture, but I just expect more from you. And I really wanted to understand what that was about. And the construct of the sins, you know, my dad's Jewish, my mom's a recovering Catholic. I grew up going to Jewish services in a Methodist church, but did not really have a particularly religious upbringing. And if anything, my mom was terrified that I would engage in Christianity or Catholicism in any way. So this was outside of I wasn't conditioned or programmed with this idea of sin. And yet I actually started with envy and initially was like, do I need to write a book about envy? Is that what's driving all of this woman-on-woman hate? And then I sort of traced it back, like, where did envy come from? And what's its etymology? And like, where did it sort of show up first in culture? And that's how I landed at the sins. And then, you know, when I looked at them, I just had this, I was on a plane and I had this sort of, oh my God, this is a checklist for women: sloth, pride, envy, greed, lust, anger, gluttony. Wow. Like, these are all things that land in me in a way that they don't land in my husband or my brother or in the culture. And so that's really where it started. And It definitely changed.
Support for today's episode comes from Cozy Earth. You know I am all about caring for ourselves, especially in these busy years with our young kids. We are pulled in so many directions, but I think it's so important for us to find ways to nurture ourselves that require no additional time from us. I should probably let you in on one of my favorite things to do to look after me, and that is to get a good night's sleep on amazing sheets. I am beyond thrilled to bring you Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding products with an exclusive Mother's Day offer just for my listeners. We've got a code. It's shrink, S-H-R-I-N-K, for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. Now, I didn't believe it until I tried them, but I firmly stand by my sleep improving with the temperature regulating technology, which adapts to your body's needs. For the past year, I have not slept on any other brand of sheets. Cozy Earth uses the very best fabrics, materials, and wares, offering superior softness for you to sink into at the end of those long days. I look forward to getting into bed, and we've been loving the sheets for over a year, and their sleepwear is so unbelievably soft, and it's made with such great quality. But the best part is that if you're worried about commitment, enjoy a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty on all of your purchases. Head over to CozyEarth.com and use promo code SHRINK for an exclusive 35% off, and give the luxury she deserves with Cozy Earth. Support for today's episode comes from Loop Earplugs. Driving in the car with the dog whining and the kids fighting in the backseat is my definition of overstimulation. And the more overstimulated I become, the more irritable I am, and then I am not the mom I want to be. So I decided to give Loop earplugs a try, and I'm so glad I did. I was blown away by how comfortable they are and just how adjustable they are for my individual needs. I also love that they're stylish in my ears and not some big chunky piece. I've been using the Loop Engage, which focuses on decreasing the amount of noise around me, whether I'm in the car with the kids or if I'm at the show. I love this option because I don't want to miss out on what's happening around me, but sometimes I just need a little bit of support. Plus, we love their kids' version, which we were able to take to the movies for our highly sensitive child. I'm so excited that Loop Earplugs is offering you, my community, a discount so that you too can tackle those overstimulating moments while also still being engaged with the activities and the people you love. Visit loopearplugs.com and use my exclusive code LOOP times Dr. Tracy for 10% off your order. That's LOOPX DRTRACY for 10% off your order at loopearplugs.com.
I think so many people can relate to that experience of keeping themselves small or hidden or behind something instead of going forward and listening and it's almost this like being sense. It's not, I don't want to say doing, because we're really good at doing as women and being the doers, but there's also this other sense of being and showing up in such a different way. And that entry into the seven deadly sins. And I remember reading through it and thinking, yes, this relates to me. And I also didn't go to church growing up, and it wasn't part of what I experienced as a child, but wow, I could relate to all of them.
Yeah.
So I have been on a clinical mission with all of my clients to help them learn to differentiate the jealousy from envy.
Yeah.
And the sense of every time I say, oh, that's interesting, you say you're jealous. Let's look at that. Huh. It sounds more like envy, and actually jealousy is this. So let's hang out in envy, because it's a really important one for us. And all of my clients will say, envy. Envy is bad. I shouldn't feel envy.
Yeah. No, they're synonymized, and they're close, but they're different. So jealousy involves a third. So you might be, you know, jealous of someone who's trying to steal your partner, right? Or there's a triangulation involved with jealousy. It's not direct, actually. And envy is one-on-one. It's far more intimate. It's when someone has something or is doing something that you want for yourself. It's far more confrontational. There's a badness, right, associated with it, besides just the fact that it's part of the seven deadly sins. And it requires a much more direct confrontation with your own wanting. Though I argue in the book, and this was my experience, that I'm so far away from, or was, now I'm much, much better at this. But I read, there was this just small moment. This was near the beginning of the idea for the book in Lori Gottlieb's book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, where she says, similar to you, I tell my clients to pay attention to their envy because it shows them what they want. And I had this just like moment with that sentence because first I had this immediate resistance. I'm not envious. I don't even know what that feels like. I don't have any envy, just this like instinct to disown. And then I had this sadder revelation of, and I don't really actually even know what I want. I'm very good at identifying what other people want and helping them get that and getting my own needs met by giving other people what they want. I think a lot of women are familiar with that construct.
The caring, the pleasing, yeah. Perfecting and performing. Yes.
Yeah. It's just we're conditioned to subjugate our wants to other people's needs, or our wants can be present if they're in service to other, you know, it's very, we figure it out in ways that I don't think we're quite even conscious of. I need to get this need met, so I'm going to give this person what they want, right? It's pretty fundamental, I think, for a lot of women. So going back to envy, this idea, for me at least, became, or what I started wanted to explore was sort of reverse engineering it from, oh, I wonder if the way to identify what you want is by noticing who in the culture of the collective irritates you and who you find yourself deprecating for no clear reasons, not for any actual behavior, but just because you just don't like them or they rub you the wrong way or who does she think she is? And we're all, as women, I think very familiar with this, like a fellow school mom friend who grates your nerves, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, there are politicians, et cetera, who grate my nerves, but I can always point to the very specific behavior. Like that is a dehumanizing way of thinking about the world, et cetera. Like it's fine to not like everyone. That's not what I'm suggesting here. Not everyone's going to be for you. But where there's really good, incredible information is when you have what is otherwise kind of a inexplicable aversion for someone. And if you just stay with it, usually what's present is something that you want, or that person has something that you want, that you envy. It might be that their children are incredibly well-behaved and high-achieving and kind. It might be that they have a slamming body, and it might be that they have a lot of money. It might be that they have a very fully realized career. Whatever it may be, typically it's sort of a fragment of something that they're experiencing that's very close to what you want. Because you'll notice too, as you talk to friends, that there are other, like you're not irritated by the same people because we all have very different wants.
Yes. Yes. It's that the wants and the needs and what's underneath that. And it's so interesting because what we are taught to do is instead of going inwards inside of us, we're taught to point outwards. And so instead of kind of rotating the room or looking at different perspectives of what's happening in this moment, we go out and we blame them or we denigrate them, we put them down. And I think that is something that we're really taught to do as women, yes, to look outward, to do the social comparisons, and to minimize, put down. And it's just a really hard experience when none of that is really about the other person. Sure, we all have people that we might not get along with.
No. Okay. And it's not conscious. And when we project, it's like essentially that the other woman is pushing on a dream that you have for yourself. And it's so hard to acknowledge that, see that, work with it, that the instinct is to project it. It's to take all that bad feeling and then push it onto the woman who's making you feel bad. So it's this vicious cycle. And the irony, of course, is that in this effort to escape feeling uncomfortable, bad, or like you're not, you know, they're pushing on a dream that you have for yourself that you haven't quite acknowledged or realized. But instead of saying, okay, great information, let me just sit with this for a minute and like, let me let this happen. When we repress, suppress, and project, and then deprecate, we end up feeling worse. None of us feel particularly good. And, you know, the sins are fascinating. They're sort of a psychological system, I think, for women and shadow in many ways, sort of what we haven't been allowed to or not haven't owned, these very human instincts, needs, impulses, but they all Venn diagram. So envy and pride are very close to each other. You hear a lot of women saying like, I don't want to be recognized. I don't want praise. I don't want attention because I don't want to inspire envy, because we recognize the way that we bat each other down. We do it to famous women in particular all the time. Mm-hmm. Any woman who dares to be seen, we allow a certain amount before we think that she's gotten too big for her britches, needs to be put back in her place. And then like knives out, she's going down. And then after a certain amount of penance, we'll let her rise like a phoenix from the ashes. And then ultimately, there's this very toxic myth of scarcity, which I write about in Greed, which is this idea that men are not, there are plenty of seats for them at the boardroom, right? There's plenty of opportunity. They help each other in the highest echelons of business and politics because they're not convinced in the way that women are. And we're convinced of this for good reason, but that there's only room for one. And in order to get that seat that is occupied by a woman, she must be dethroned. She must be done away with. That instead of sort of eyeing the men at the table and saying, okay, how do we like create more equity here? How do we change the balance of power in this room? Let's help each other. We're just programmed to see each other as the one who needs to be dethroned. Therefore, if she has something, then I can't have it too. If she has a best-selling book, then that means she's taken that spot. That's how you'll catch yourself thinking this. Instead of saying, okay, actually, wait, because she's doing this, it shows what's possible. So I'm going to use it as a path for potential and opportunity. I'm going to study her. I'm going to see what she's doing rather than I need to destroy her in order to make room for me.
In 2021, I found myself in a bath. I was literally in a bath, but it was like a bath of envy. And I was looking outwards, having spent several years already building a social media platform as a therapist, which not many people were doing that in 2018 when I had started. And then I saw the people who I started with start to publish books. Mm-hmm. And it was this feeling of, why you? Why? Oh, that's not going to be. And it was literally a bath of envy. And recognizing it was this aha moment of, I need to stop being so scared. Mm-hmm. I need to write the book. I need to take all of the steps and do this thing because that's what I want and that's what I need. And it was such a powerful shift in how I was looking outward to then go inward and say, what steps do I need to take to get to that place?
Yeah.
And then just to celebrate so many other people who are having bestseller books, who are out there writing or self-publishing or all of the things. It was quite a powerful shift.
Yeah. And I will offer for anyone listening that in this moment of time, it's still uncomfortable. You're going to encounter resistance and scarcity from other people wherever you go. So it's like there's some heartbreak in this process. I don't know if that's been your experience as well. We're just not there culturally. However, it shouldn't inhibit or stop you from doing it. Mm-hmm. And if anything, if this conversation is resonant and you're able to say, okay, let me think through the sand on my pearl in my sort of direct community or online, like who's grading me? Who is grading me? Richard Schwartz calls them tormentors. Mm-hmm. They're your mentors. They're your greatest teachers. So as you start to pay attention and then use that to sort of draft a map or an idea of what your soul is trying to communicate to you, there's a certain amount of, like, not power in that, but there's a certain amount of clarity that's hopefully enough to push you. Because then once you're moving and once you're working with the universe, you'll encounter all sorts of hurdles. You'll encounter foes. You'll also encounter friends. But it's so much more rewarding, I guess, than not doing the thing at all and or hoping somehow that there'll be some other type of intervention, you know. But this is it. Like, the envy is the knock on the door. It's your job to open the door, I think, and just say, okay, what is there? And what am I going to do about it?
It's the other piece too of recognizing that when someone is not able to support you in what you're doing, so you've made the choice, you open the door, you listen to what's calling for you and you go and do it, then acknowledging that not everybody is going to be where you are. And to mm-hmm. see that others is perhaps negative comments or perceptions of you are not about you and what mm-hmm. it is that you're doing, but it does come from something within themselves. And I think that's where people are really trying to make this big shift of understanding this.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And I think that there's, as you encounter criticism, you can tell as you sort of hold it. Is this something that you hold against yourself? And maybe there's work to be done there. Or can you just take this as someone else's projection of their own undiagnosed envy or that part of them that's having this, why you, how dare you, who do you think you are response, which is, like, in many ways, not your problem, not your work. So sometimes there's work in there and sometimes there's not. And part of this process, I don't know if this was similar for you, of writing this book and bringing out into the world, is attending to all my longing. Because I think that as part of it, and as this ghostwriter and, you know, working for many powerful people in the culture, there was always this sort of hoping, longing, desire to be seen. And I certainly have been. I'm not suggesting that I haven't been, but this, like, don't make me ask or don't make me put myself out there. Can you just, like, pluck me? I remember talking to this young, when I was a magazine editor at Condé Nast, and I don't know, I'd had this revelation when I was, maybe 26, and I had been at the same magazine, and I had sort of a toxic, abusive coworker who was persecuting me, and I needed to leave. Like, I couldn't, it was becoming unhealthy, and there was no help coming from inside the building, and I had this sort of moment where I was like, oh, right. Like, the world doesn't work like this. No hand of God is going to come down and pluck me out and sort of dust me off and I need to put myself in motion. Mm-hmm. And it all sort of worked out. It was hard. It took me 6 months, a year to find my next job. And it was painful, but it was a really good moment for me, even though I don't know that I actually completely internalized it until or ever even have, because I've gone through life, and I'd say the bringing the book out into the world was a good, maybe the final passage of this particular part of my life of, you know, I'd spent the first 20 years of my career accruing favors, right? And just being like, I'm gonna, you know, do my best to be a good person. I'm gonna, like, work really hard for other people. You know, I was a magazine writer, so it's like I was highlighting, you know, businesses, blogger. I was, like, one of the first journalists at a magazine to cover the internet and blogger. I gave a lot of big bloggers their first press. And anyway, interviewed tons of people in my last job where I had a very big platform. And so I sort of came into this book saying, oh, wow, like, there are a lot of people who I've done a lot of things for. And clearly, I've never asked anyone for anything. So this is clearly the moment of reciprocation. And it was what I did, because initially I was sort of like skating towards pub day. And I was like, they'll just know. I had all this unspoken longing. I hope that they realize that this is the moment, right? That they recognize, like, everything's transactional. Because I do think everything, I mean, even love, the most loving relationships mm-hmm. are transactional as a bad word. But I was talking to another author, and he was, whose book was coming out, and he was like, how can I help you? And he's very overt. He was very overt about asking me for my support. I've interviewed him several times. And I was like, how do I do this? You know, to a man, like, how do you do that? What do you do? And he was like, you have to make it overt. You have to ask. You can't just expect that people are going to support you. Make it overt. You write and you say, hey, I would love your support. If this book is present, whatever. He gave me some script lines. It was amazing that he had to tell me that, but that's where we are. But he was like, you can't leave it. You can't like leave it on the court. If you don't ask, you'll always wonder. Make every, and then I did, I love Carl Jung. So I went into like a deep transactional, read some papers about transactional shadow vows, which is like what we bring into every relationship, all the covert longing and wanting that we very rarely even acknowledge to ourselves, right? Like all the covert longing and wanting, the fantasies that you have about your husband that you're about to marry or whatever it is, like the fantasy that you're telling yourself in your head. And so I did it. I made all of my covert wanting and longing overt. And it was hard because I was disappointed by a lot of people. And I'm so glad I asked. It was so clarifying. Like sometimes it's just so much better to be like, okay, now I see, I understand. Anyway, I don't even know how we got onto that, but
no, it's great, Elise. That is the hardest piece though, because we do things to try to avoid feeling disappointment.
Yeah.
A, because no one helped us learn how to get through it. And B, because it's so uncomfortable. I had said to someone I was working with that their job is to say no to their child and that it's okay that, you know, no, it's not a bag of cookies at 8 p.m. before bedtime, or no, we can't do 10 activities in 1 week because it's not good for our family. But then our job as parents is to help our children cope through that sense of disappointment. But yeah. As soon as you said that you were disappointed, I could just feel my whole body reacting to that because I know that. And that is, it's the hoping and the longing that they will give it back to you.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't come back and it feels so hard. And it's a really hard truth. And also too, though, there's in existential therapy, we talk about leaving it all out on the table, that each moment is a meaningful moment. If you're going to end session, what is it that you'd like to finish here today? What is that one thing you would like to say so that you don't look back with regrets?
Yeah.
And that is essentially the, I'm going to ask, I will ask all of them. So then I never have to wonder about whether they would or wouldn't have.
Exactly. 100%. Because the disappointment, sure, it hurts, but it's very survivable. Mm-hmm. And there is a clarifying, and it's a muscle building, you know, because I think so many of us never ask because, and as women, we're certainly conditioned not to. I mean, I write about this in the lust chapter, but it has wider implications. But this idea of sort of always chosen, never choosing, always desirable, never desiring. And so much of this is so, it's so deep in our subconscious, this like, I'll just look pretty over here on the sidelines. I'll be picked. Mm. It's a certain type of passivity that I think we're taught as women that that's what's seemly. That's what's appropriate. You're not supposed to go out there and get what you want or ask for what you want. Obviously, we're now conditioned to this. We're sort of blamed for the lack of equity, which is maddening to me. The whole like, negotiate harder, ask for what you want, demand what you deserve. It's like, no, every woman knows. I mean, it's not, I know some, maybe imposter syndrome is a real thing, but I don't know. I don't really know many women who are having confidence crises. I think if anything, many of us look around and think, God, like put me in, I would do a much better job. But we know better than to show that or express that. Or we're incredible negotiators, particularly when we're negotiating on behalf of other people. But the way that we're sort of blamed for a lack of equity is maddening. You know, don't use weak language. Don't, it's like, well, we know how to survive. Mm-hmm. Don't lecture us. We've been, you know, doing our best in a world not really built for us.
Yes. Yeah. Which in some ways comes to anger, which is another emotion that I think a lot of women don't allow themselves to feel.
Yeah.
And your article, The Six Ways Women Undermine Themselves, you put in the expression, which I hear all the time, the expression, I shouldn't be so upset that my husband forgot to schedule the kids', I think you said, dentist appointment.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
Just in terms of partnership? I mean, like the
and anger, allowing ourselves to feel angry.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, and this is, I write about this in the anger chapter, which is very much built on the work of Harriet Lerner, who wrote The Dance of Anger. But there is an inherent fear, I think, for women to express our anger and displeasure that we'll lose our relationships. It's so incredibly alienating. You know, we have a million words for an angry woman: crazy, shrew, like lots of expletives. I won't swear on your podcast, but, you know, people can. And then even with a man, we call him a son of a bee or a bastard. We still find a way to sort of blame the mother, blame the woman. But there's this just sort of inherent basic fear that if I assert myself, if I am angry, I will lose love. I will lose partnership. My partner, if I'm married to a man, will go and find someone more pleasing, more conciliatory. So much of us have sort of abandoned ourselves and, again, our own needs to create a comfortable environment for other people, to be diplomatic, to sort of be like, I'll be the one to give here, because displeasure, discomfort are intolerable, because what I'm really asking is for my husband or partner to change. And he might not change or want to change or work on this relationship. And then what? So there's a tremendous amount of self-sacrifice. And our aversion to, and I think there are lots of ways to metabolize and move our anger in very constructive, essential, boundary-establishing, life-changing ways. So it's not, the anger chapter isn't sort of like a just scream and yell and allow every emotion, just be an outburst, right? Although I think
go hit your pillow.
Go hit your pillow. But women can do that too. But there's ways to use our anger, particularly when we're really skilled in conversation, to land a point without necessarily creating an intractable conflict, which is to say to that partner who failed to schedule the appointment, I'm angry because I am needing to know that I don't need to do everything. I'm angry because I am needing to know that you're also paying attention. It's just much less direct. I mean, and I like direct communication, but it's much less blaming and sort of putting yourself immediately into a victim, a drama triangle with like the victim and the villain, where you're always playing the hero. And when you can create enough space so that the other person can step in and acknowledge their part without feeling like they're sort of receiving all of your rage.
I think it's so important for us to understand. And Brené Brown talks a little bit about this too. The difference between anger as a secondary or primary emotion. Is this an emotion about an emotion, or is this more of that core emotion? Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for us not to downplay those moments where something doesn't feel just or fair. Those are times where we are angry, when someone commits to doing something and then doesn't uphold their commitment. That anger makes sense. And that doesn't give you permission then to go, because this is often what we do, right? And Harriet Lerner's book was groundbreaking for me. I read it over 10 years ago, gave it to a friend. Her husband saw it on the bedside table and was like, do we have a problem here? We're still going to laugh about that story. And also too, that she says at the beginning of the book, how many years it took her to get it published, because nobody in the 80s wanted to publish a book about women being angry.
Nope.
And we haven't
come that far.
I know. Right. It's just, Gosh, and then I'm getting derailed here, but I'm even just thinking about how still with children today, how it was so acceptable for my daughter to get hurt and cry and those soft emotions were okay, but to not be angry, and that for my son to stand up and brush it off. And those messages are still here.
You know, this is, I write about Rachel, is her name Snyder, Odd Girl Out, an amazing book. Rachel Simmons, sorry. And she looks, it's about sort of aggression in girls and the way that it's socialized. And this is still so, so insistent in the way that our kids are raised, or our expectations for boys and girls. It's so deep. And again, this is where we then immediately go to like, oh, it's just their nature. It's like, no, we're all socialized. It's impossible to distinguish nature from culture because we're all socialized from birth, right? So, but it's this idea that girls and boys are both incredibly aggressive. They have a lot of aggression. It's part, we're animals, you know, ultimately we have a lot of aggression. It's very human. It's very natural to need to sort of want to express ourselves fully. Kids are great at it. Babies are tremendous at it. Watch them get pissed and cry all the time, right? But we socialize them out of it. And for boys and their aggression, it's completely acceptable, if not venerated at times or sort of adored, that they yell and they push and they shove and they fight, right? There's an expectation that boys will be boys and that's what they do. Girls, on the other hand, are not allowed to do that. Girls don't do that. And so all that present aggression comes out in covert ways. So it's whispering, alliance building, backstabbing. It's covert social aggression. There's nowhere else for all of these feelings to go, you know? And then we're told, like, that's just who girls are. They're just catty bitches, you know? But it's how we're conditioned to express ourselves. We're not allowed to sort of punch, push, and kick and scream.
One of the most cathartic things for me in terms of really making space for my anger was going to a gym class, a more of a martial arts focused gym class. And it was just one of those moving it through my body and allowing myself to have that feeling and use it in that way to get it out. But then also spending time asking myself, what's underneath this for me? What is it telling me that I need? And how can I start listening to that? What do I need to communicate?
Anger is so important. It's that sort of don't tread on me. I have needs. A boundary is being crossed. Mm-hmm. You know, I think sometimes it's just irritation, right? There's sort of the scale. I mean, I think sometimes we just all wake up grumpy, but essential anger is exactly that. It's essential. And it is one of the primary ways that we, our bodies and how we communicate with ourselves.
There's so much more to uncover. I know your book is just filled with so many insights and pieces for us to move forward. I recommend everyone to go and grab it. I have one more question for you. What is something that you are doing each day, or what is one way of being that helps you live a meaningful life?
I recognize now, and this is a great luxury, having, you know, now working for myself for the past 3 years, but I need a lot of time by myself and I need a lot of time to be quiet. And I like to go on a sort of hour-long loop in my neighborhood. And I do, I guess you would call it a walking meditation. I'm not a good sitter. I can't just struggle to sit and meditate, but this is my version of just being with myself. It's where I get the most inspiration. I have sort of those like the most aha moments. I have my phone so I can text myself as I walk, but I really need, I sort of think of it as like my emotional hygiene time where I'm just processing, thinking, and moving things throughout my body without, and the movement is essential for me. So if anyone's listening who can't sit, you're not alone. Really can't sit and meditate. So There are other ways.
And that's okay. There are other ways. We don't need to get stuck in defining this this wellness piece of meditation as a dimly lit room with candles on your yoga mat and you are sitting on a puff cushion with, right? It's not for everybody that way. But there are ways to make contact. I think what you're speaking here is come to the present moment, be in my body, and tune out the noise of everything else.
Yeah. It's essential hygiene.
Thank you so much, Elise, for being here.
Thank
with me
you.
For your book. I know your book is going to stay on our shelves for so many years to come. It is such a key piece. I have all the links in the show notes where people can find you and grab your book.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode. Over the next week, I want to encourage you to spend some time noticing and paying attention to some of those uncomfortable emotions that show up within us, including anger and envy, and spend some more time slowing down and asking yourself, what is this telling me? What is it that I'm wanting? What is it that I'm needing? And I love going into our core needs because one of the things that we didn't get to talk about on the episode is how those needs can be really important to listen to. And needs are not, I need you to clean up. I need you to help. Yes, those are actionable things that we require, but they're not our core needs. Our core needs are things like connection, attention, to feel like we matter, to feel adequate. Our core needs are things like needing power and freedom and our own sense of agency. I'm so glad you joined us today. Don't forget to like, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Also, you can submit your questions to me to be answered here on the pod. You can do that on my website, drtracyd.com/podcast. I love getting your questions and being able to spend time deep diving into them here. And if you haven't yet, be sure to check out some of my resources available to you. I have my free masterclass so that you can learn how to repair with your partner after the fight. I know so many people have benefited from taking this short session with me. You're going to walk away with several tools, including understanding one of my top ways to help you go back and repair. And it's not what you think. Until next time, take good care of you, and I'll see you next week. Remember, this podcast is for educational purposes only and does not substitute for the care from a licensed mental health care provider.
Settling is not an option for me. Everything I desire is already mine. What if you can have it all? Because every day is for the girls.
Hello, hello. Welcome to For the Girls podcast, hosted by Victoria Alario for the girls who want more. Listening to For the Girls will have you ready to raise the bar, stop settling for the bare minimum, and start believing you can have it all, and step into the 2.0 version of you. You can catch a new episode of For the Girls every Monday across all podcast platforms. Until next time, girls.